This week, the Hawaii State Teachers Association reached an agreement with the state in talks over its new proposed four-year contract. Yesterday, the union held a ratification vote, and teachers almost unanimously agreed. Of note is how quickly the agreement was reached and the absence of the rancor president past negotiations. HSTA Secretary-Treasurer Amy Peruso joins us now with some of the backstory. So why do you think this time around things seem to be so smooth and that there wasn't this sense of upset and anger and rancor and a lot of the headlines that we have seen in past negotiations?
I think that there are several factors at play. I think that we adopted a new strategy with this contract, and that is to share all of our contract proposals with our membership and to really ground them in student-centered advocacy. So it was kind of a broad-based approach that came from our listening tour. We listened to teachers. We had lots of surveys and conversations, and that really informed our contract proposal. So teachers felt like their interests, not just their interests, their material interests as teachers, but also their aspirations for public education were addressed in the contract proposal.
Specifically, Amy, can you take that apart a little bit and tell us what was different about what you heard this time around from other years when there have been contract negotiations?
Well, I think, do you mean from the employer or from our teachers?
From your teachers and their sense of being able to participate sort of on the front end and be able to weigh in on what was important to them and why.
Right. So this is the first time that we have made our contract proposals completely transparent to our membership. So it really invited the members into the process, into the conversation. So when we shared it out with them, then we also took feedback on, their insights into how we could modify our proposals or strengthen our proposals. And I think that contributed to a sense of ownership. We really felt that this was a collaborative effort. This was, the teachers were coming together to say that this is what we want for public education.
We've heard a lot in past about what teachers were upset with in other contracts.
Mm-hmm.
But this time around, what were some of the major issues that teachers came together to support?
I think the central elements of our contract proposal were salary and benefits, of course, because we have a teacher shortage crisis, and a lot of that has to do with our failure to pay teachers adequately. And I think another important element was the evaluation system. But just as important to teachers were these issues of special education. We think that the needs of our students with special needs are not being met. And we are very concerned about the impact that class size has on student learning. So those were some of the main issues, not the only issues, but some of the main issues that we thought to address at the table.
And how did that go when you were talking with the state? Because some of those issues have come up before, but this time,
mm-hmm.
again, it seemed to be that there was a sense of openness to this on the part of the state.
You know, it's interesting. I don't think that there was a monolithic state response. I think that the response from the department was disheartening and something that we hope to address in the future because they essentially were very non-responsive to our desire to address special education and class size and other social justice issues. It was extremely frustrating, but on the other side, we really saw the governor rise to the challenge. He really got into the discussion and spent a lot of time at the table helping the sides work out an arrangement, a contract that we could agree on as a way of going forward, right? This is not our best solution or our best possible contract, but we see it as a way to continue movement forward.
Do you look at this as a situation where the governor brokered this deal?
I would say that this contract would not have happened without the governor. I don't think he just brokered it. I think he, we would not have a contract without the governor.
That's not something that we've heard in a while.
Yeah.
Because this is a very different situation, and going forward now we're looking at a four-year contract, not sure exactly what will happen the next time around when the election comes. But as you now look at how you've been able to create a different climate, a really different culture within, you know, organizations of schools and complexes, and now with the governor, what of this do you think you're going to be able to say was on the part of how leadership at HSTA was able to approach this, as opposed to the fact that you had a governor who was very open to hearing what you had to say? How do you continue on to be able to make this move into you know, greater spheres with your teachers and across Hawaii?
Right. So I think our approach has been different in the sense that we are interested in organizing and activating our teachers and helping them see themselves as agents of change. And I think that that is work that is ongoing. It definitely doesn't stop here. I think that we've only just begun. But I do think that we have also taken a different approach to our engagement with the community. So we've been reaching out to different community organizations, to neighborhood boards, and really trying to reconnect communities with their neighborhood schools. And we're starting to see that that's something that people crave and hasn't really been made available to them. And we're also trying to raise the level of discussion, make it more student-centered at the Board of Education and even at the legislature. You know, we had an extraordinarily disappointing failure with our constitutional amendment this session. And I think that that was a real blow to teachers because they really came together behind that proposal, and it made sense to the community. And I think that we have so much work still to do. You're right that we have made important progress, but I think there are a lot of challenges ahead.
Clearly, and we don't mean to whitewash any of this, but in going forward in a way that seems to be very different than what we've seen before, it seems that in reaching out to these communities and bringing them in, it's very different than what we saw in the days of old when we had the school community-based management idea and trying to be able to localize it, but localize it very differently than the way you've been able to accomplish by reaching out to your communities.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the landscape is slightly different, too. And I think the leadership at the state level is different. So I think that under No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top, you had a Governor Abercrombie and a Board of Education and a DOE that were very much all in line with a certain direction of policy that a lot of teachers disagreed with. So I think that what you're seeing is that people are starting to listen to teachers more. I would say not enough, but I think that we're asserting that we are in the classrooms, we work with students on a daily basis, and we should be considered the authorities on instructional assessment and curriculum issues.
So you're really talking about inverting some of the way the leadership team has been running up to this point.
Correct.
So now that you have this under your belt and there's a lot of happiness, you've got 98% of the teachers who voted last night happy about all of this, and you mentioned challenges ahead. What's the very next thing you think needs to be tackled?
We have two finalists for the superintendent position. And so that's something that we are just starting to delve into. I don't know if you've been watching the news coverage, but both of them are outsiders, unfamiliar with our system, and we are also unfamiliar with their qualifications and their leadership qualities. So we're going to be doing some research around that. And then we also have the state ESSA plan. So the Department of Education is pushing forward a state ESSA plan, and we are cautioning about some of the elements that just reproduce the status quo from the past. So those two areas we're going to continue to work immediately. And I think looking forward, we're also going to be tackling the funding issue, hopefully with a constitutional amendment.
You know, you brought up an issue before I could get to it, and I'm glad that you did. The idea that both of these candidates are outsiders. On one hand, people say, well, you know, you come to it with fresh eyes. You bring some other ideas. There's a lot of cross-pollination that can happen. On the other side of it is, well, they don't necessarily know Hawaii as well as somebody who has been here and may not be able to affect change as well. Then back on the other side, the idea, well, if they've come up through this situation here in Hawaii, that there may be too much familiarity breeding contempt kind of idea. And so there are sides of this, so many different sides of it and arguments that you could make. But your position seems to be that you're not taking a stand on either one of these candidates. So you're simply looking for good information.
Correct. And I do think that we want to be fair in our treatment of both candidates. And that's why it's important to us, especially as a teachers union, that we do our homework and make sure that our positions are evidence-based. And I think that all of the positions that have been articulated are reasonable positions. We just have to think about what is going to be best in terms of moving forward, healing the trauma that has really characterized the Department of Education for a while now, and thinking about what kinds of qualities that leader will require.
All right, teachers going off to do their homework. A lot of students will be happy to hear about that, too, and what that will mean for them. Thanks, Amy.
Okay, thank you so much.
Amy Peruso is a National Board Certified Social Studies teacher at Mililani High School, and she also teaches AP U.S. History and AP Government. She is the Secretary Treasurer of the Hawaii State Teachers Association, and last night, 98% of the teachers who voted ratified the new four-year contract.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, a conversation with a rock and roll pioneer. But first, your quiz.
And with the successful conclusion of the pledge drive, we get to get back to backyard quizzes. So here we go. The Merry Monarch Festival wrapped up last Saturday, and you might have been one of the fortunate ticket holders sitting in the Edith Kanaka Ole Stadium watching the beautiful competition unfold in real time. But did you know that back in 1963, when the festival just started, it didn't include hula. Instead, the Merry Monarch Festival featured a Kalakaua beard look-alike contest, a recreation of the king's coronation, and relay races across many of the events. It wasn't until 1971 that hula became part of the festivities. The halau competitions for ancient and modern styles have been the mainstay ever since, as well as the solo dance competition for Miss Aloha Hula. So let's test your Merry Monarch trivia. Who was the very first winner of the Miss Aloha Hula competition? Now, here's a hint. With a name like hers, she was a perfect fit for the title.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ekahi Ornish Lifestyle Medicine, Hawaii Pacific University, and Ulupono Initiative.
The world of popular music turned upside down when the Beatles took hold in America, filling young musicians with a "we can do it" spirit that led to the formation of thousands of bands. Sadly, few of them were female, but June Millington's band, Fanny, the first all-women's band to be signed to a major record label, was an exception, winning the admiration of its peers around the world. June's now in her fifth decade as a performer and as an inspiration to young women. She's in the islands for a series of public appearances, and we spoke with her yesterday about the effect the Beatles had on her musical growth.
They were bringing back American music, so it was really incredible that it was cyclic. I mean, I had not listened to, for example, the blues growing up in Manila. Mm-hmm. But when we heard, American music coming back here via the Brits, for some reason, we all understood that it was something that was already familiar, but it was new and it was exciting. And it was so unexpected. And it was right after Kennedy was killed, you know, that John F. Kennedy was killed, that the Beatles appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show. And that was totally galvanizing. So the timing of everything was super important, and it just worked. It worked. I can't, sort of stress enough how important those club gigs were and the gigs at Air Force bases, military bases down to Santa Cruz, and teen centers were starting as we were really getting going with our band, the Svelts. Mm-hmm. Teen centers were a new invention, and they were so exciting and so fun. That meant we had more gigs. Now, that's very important to understand. You know, you don't just, like, start a band and just play in your room. Really, that's not the thing to do.
Yeah.
You have to have access to equipment and a chance to play out. Because when you're playing for people who are, well, in my case, I really feel the dancing part is important. We weren't doing listening concerts. We were doing music in which people were wanting to dance. And that, of course, united us all. Nobody was thinking about anything, you know,
right.
When we were all playing and dancing to, say, like Boogaloo Down Broadway. You know, I'm in with the in crowd.
Uh-huh.
Do you believe in magic? Walk the dog. Midnight Hour. My Girl. I mean, it was incredible. So we just kept honing our skills, but the honing our skills was so much fun. You know, every song just seemed to get sort of more, wow, what's this? You know, it's so great.
Yeah. Well, it also, the time was a transition from the record hop to live music, and there was an enormous demand for live music in that era, so you were able to catch that wave.
Yep. We were part of fulfilling the demand, and we had a corner on the market, because maybe there was another all-girl band in the area, but we didn't know of it.
Mm-hmm.
So we pretty much had, the gigs that could be covered by a hot all-girl band. And we were into it, man. We could sing. We learned our harmonies. We practiced, but we got good grades. And that's also important, you know. I would need to stress that our experience with the type of music that was being played in Northern California, where you have Cold Blood, where you have Janis Joplin, you know,
mm-hmm.
where you have The Dead, was way different than what we found when we moved to Southern California. And that was another phase that was just as important. You know, now you're getting to the Flying Burrito Brothers. You're getting into Steely Dan, who I knew Skunk quite well, as it turned out, over the years, because he was my guitar repairman.
Mm-hmm.
You have a different caliber. You have the Southern California sound. I mean, I remember once... after going on the road with Fanny, we'd, of course, come back to L.A. and still be rehearsing. We rehearsed at a place, and we were told by our road manager that we had to really, really quit at 5 o'clock or whatever it was. We couldn't be late because there was another band waiting to rehearse right after us. And I saw those guys came in, and they just had, like, that 1,000-yard stare. You know, they had a job to do. They were very serious about it.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Eagles, you know? And that's a very different discipline than what was happening in Northern California with, flower power and the allure of psychedelia and its own mystical story that was creating itself, you know, and Bill Graham helped create that along with the music. So that was a whole a whole mystical quest that was quite different from what was happening in Southern California. Southern California was kind of drier, it is in weather, and a super business-like approach.
Where do you think it's going now for young women who want to play rock and roll? Do you think there are as many opportunities as you had?
You know, I don't think there's as many opportunities to play live.
No.
You know?
Yeah.
And that, I think that is, for me, that's a regret because, as I said, playing live is one of the ways in which you really start to work out, work out the jam, so to speak, where you get to the excitement and you experiment and you might fail. I mean, for example, for us, I remember people really like our version, Fanny's version of Hey Bulldog, and I remember our falling in love with that song, but just kind of leaving that as it was and already knowing that we had to create something that was our own. And so we rehearsed that in the living room at Fanny Hill, and then we went out and played it at gigs along with the rest of our set, trying it out. And, it's like trying on a pair of clothes or trying on a bicycle or something. You find out where its parameters are and where it stretches and where it's yours. And, we were able to get into that song and try it on like a piece of clothing, a suit, and make it ours. And you can still hear that today. I mean, I hear it today. I'm still a fan of our recording of Hey Bulldog. And it's simply because we had the opportunity to learn how to shape something, how to practice, how to get out in front of an audience and take chances and see what works.
Well, let's hope that that kind of momentum continues for another, for the next generations to come, June.
Well, I would certainly like to see it happen, and I am, I'm determined to be part of the women or the people on this earth who are helping carry the torch forward with the music that we've been developing, And it takes really attention and a willingness to go with the arduousness of doing the work. It's not easy. I mean, I am a student of music. I love arrangements. I love studying Bacharach and David, for example, their arrangements, and many, many other people. I collect recording stories. I think it's all fascinating, and that informs what I do on stage and how I write and how I would approach recording something, for example. So maybe I'm unusual. Maybe I got bitten by the bug. But in addition to that, I was lucky in that our band got signed when we were, like 20, 21 and ended up in L.A. And I had the opportunity to watch a lot of people work. And then we went on the road and we got to watch a lot of people perform. I mean, we would open for them or, double bill. So when you're by the time we played, for example, with the Staple Singers, I guess I would have been 23, 24. And believe me, I watched them like a hawk. I mean, I thought that was incredibly special music, So
that
type of thing where you build yourself up and you know that you're still learning and there it is, you've been led to the water, all you have to do is drink, right?
Uh-huh.
Very lucky, very lucky. I just love music and I love American music in particular. I'm a student of it. And I guess partly it's because my father was American and we grew up in Manila, and my sister and I were playing ukuleles sitting by the transistor radio. So we were learning songs off the radio, I mean, there's nothing like singing an Everly Brothers song with two ukuleles and two harmonies.
And there's nothing like a life in music, June, is there?
It's so fulfilling and it's so nice, and I feel so lucky to be able to continue and know that I can help a lot of people, both by playing, like standing in front of people. I mean, I just turned 69, so a lot of people can see me do what I do, I think, just as well as I was doing it when I was 20.
June Millington will be reading from her memoir, Land of a Thousand Bridges, today at noon in the Aloha Tower Marketplace Multipurpose Room. It's free, as is her performance this evening at Crossroads at Hawaiian Brian's in Honolulu. On Saturday, May 6th, she'll be at Hawaiian Sanctuary outside of Hilo.
Sheepdog, standing in the rain.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrew Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
And as it is an Aloha Friday, an especially wonderful Aloha Friday, as we have successfully completed the pledge drive, and many, many thanks to everyone who made that happen. Well, you know, one of the Friday things we do is to read your letters and emails.
After our story on remembering the Kinder transport that saved thousands of Jewish children from Nazi Germany, Rachel Heckscher shared this on Facebook. Thank you for this story. My father was a Kinder transport child. He was one of the oldest, age 17, when he left. He was reunited with his parents later in 1939 after they were granted a visa to the United States. There's an interesting Hawaii connection to the story. Rosemary Mild of Honolulu is the granddaughter of the man who sponsored my grandparents' visa to the U.S. Harry Bregarnik was a Jewish resident of Milwaukee, known as the Good Deed Man. When he heard about my grandparents from a Christian woman, Rosa, who used to be their maid, he helped Rosa get a U.S. visa for them, which amazingly got my grandfather released from a concentration camp.
What an amazing story. Now, following my conversation with Representative Marcus Oshiro about the need to keep Waihua General Hospital financially solvent, Rose Darling said this: with traffic at a daily standstill on the H1, it only makes sense to keep Waihua General fully funded and open. Mahalo, Representative Marcus Oshiro, for fighting on behalf of Central Oahu and the North Shore communities.
Thanks for the feedback. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, 792-8217.
We talk a lot about policy changes in the Trump administration, but many of them have implications for nonprofits. But are Hawaii's nonprofits taking note? And are they planning for when the economy moves into a downward cycle and more will be asked of them? As part of my ongoing conversation with the head of the Hawaii Alliance of Nonprofit Organizations, Lisa Mariama, we sat down when she was in our studio. I asked her what she's hearing from her members and how concerned are they that the changes they see are happening in Washington will affect them.
There's a lot of anxiety of the unknown. There seem to be changes daily and posturing, you know, from both sides in Congress. It's really hard to kind of keep our finger on what's actually really happening, but we're hearing that we may have bought ourselves some time for 2017, that with a possible extension and renewal of a continuing resolution for the federal budget, that things may just be status quo for this fiscal year. But, you know, the next fiscal year is a completely different story in terms of possible funding cuts that could come down in complete line of impact, you know, where nonprofits actually are providing services, there are cuts that will impact what they're doing in our communities.
So does that mean that nonprofits are really starting to scenario plan, because there is so much that's unknown, that to be able to say if this happens, then if this other thing happens, then maybe this, and
exactly,
also look at alternate ways of not being so dependent upon federal funds?
Right. You know, and I also want to qualify that I think our state departments are also doing scenario planning and hopefully in concert with our nonprofit service deliverers. But yes, they have to do programmatic scenario planning around different outcomes that will happen in the next couple of years. But they also, so not just the cuts, but they have to think about ideologically, you know, where they are departing from goals or values with this administration policy, and, you know, where their missions are at a crossroads. They really have to think about new programmatic strategies. They have to double down on some of the things they're doing. They have to be able to to corral their resources and even new resources that might be coming in to manage those things carefully to be able to have impact. There's also a need for advocacy. They have to look at these policies that might be changing and actually really be vigilant and advocate for their missions at the end of the day.
We've said policy several times, but as you are talking about it in specific ways, what do you have in mind? I mean, are we talking about issues that would be derived from having a changed EPA head,
exactly,
for example?
So being vigilant if the new EPA head, for instance, really interprets things differently around, you know, land, water quality, et cetera, that just really have to be vigilant to make sure that we're really, according to our missions, not really accommodating that kind of leniency. You know, there's also just public broadcasting. Even this station can possibly be threatened by future impacts. You know, they're thinking about Medicaid, Medicare. We know Social Security is pretty safe this year already, but you just don't know what the future holds. And then, of course, you know, NEA, the National Endowment for the Arts, there's a lot of posturing going on with that budget. I know that the State Department is ready. You know, there have been a lot of talks about the State Department taking a lot of cuts, and what does that mean for international relations here in Hawaii? So there are a lot of different areas that impact different missions across our state.
So, Lisa, as organizations that you're in touch with are beginning to really look at this, if they are indeed looking at it, are they also understanding that they can't be looking to just foundational support to replace federal funds, that they're going to have to change the way they go after donors and really understand who those donors are?
Right, absolutely. And, you know, I think the conversations with the philanthropic community here in Hawaii have been nascent. You know, they're ongoing and new, and I think everybody's trying to figure it out. We're encouraged that at the national level, there are national foundations that are actually really taking bold stances in the wake of the elections. And so, for instance, the Ford Foundation is now going to invest $1 billion over the next 10 years to, they're going to spend it around mission-related investments. An example is if they've looked across the country and they see that affordable housing is a need in many communities, they're actually going to develop or invest in, buy affordable housing units, and actually their return on investment comes in the form of appreciation of the value of those units or rental income, et cetera. But they're starting to think about investing in ways like a venture capitalist would or a developer might. But they realize that they have a lot of leverage in the community and they can look at these big, big social issues and actually make an impact that way.
Do we have any indication that some of those foundations are looking at us?
We would hope. You know, the Ford Foundation funds nationwide, and so we would encourage organizations here who are thinking about those very issues to definitely look into it. MRIs, that's the new concept.
Affordable housing has been such an issue for us, and obviously in not just the foreseeable future, but in the long-term future, we're going to see this being an issue for us. For organizations who might be involved with this, what do they need to do? Do they need to reach out to these national foundations or organizations or hope that they're already looking at Hawaii?
Yeah, definitely looking into these new methods of investment. You know, there are also, outside of the philanthropic community, there are also private investors that are looking at impact investing and are looking for good partners in the community. And here in Hawaii, we're seeing a fledgling, a good group of investors that are looking into social impact, you know, and entrepreneurial thinking from nonprofits where they can be good partners to actually do social change. So I think that's a new conversation, too. It's growing. We should encourage that. And we should encourage nonprofits to look into it. There are lots of different ways in which also you can be creative with your private foundation. Where we heard an example the other day about a foundation actually being a guarantor on a loan for a nonprofit in order to have them qualify to buy a building or to rent a building. And these are things that smaller nonprofits with smaller capacities really couldn't imagine unless they had a guarantor like that. So foundations can play different roles, creative roles, instead of just providing the programmatic grant or the unrestricted grant.
Mission-driven financing,
exactly,
in very creative ways we've not really seen until now.
Right.
But that also means that there's still a role for donors, the good old-fashioned donor. But the old-fashionedness of it is very much in question, because we have to look at who those donors are, knowing that we've got over 25% of Gen Zers who are mobile only. And, you know, their parents, the Gen Xers, who are now very involved, but they also have the money to be very involved. And then, of course, there are the baby boomers who want to stay involved until they drop dead. You have very, very committed people in very different groups. Mm-hmm. They need to be reached in a different way, perhaps.
So not saying that we put all our, all of our ideas into one basket. I think we still need to have different approaches and different communication strategies for these different groups. But we should be spending some time actually looking at how we're going to engage the younger generations, whether it's the millennials or the Generation Z. And in that, it's mobile only for them, really, that we really need to be devising new ways in which to reach out to them. So there are some things that are encouraging. Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, and YouTube all have abilities to donate online.
And then there's Rage.
Right. And then, you know, we talked about Rage Donate, right? So in response to the election and some of the rights that are being abridged across different communities, there is an opportunity on a website called Rage Donate to just give, even in small ways, to different organizations. Now, the organizations that are listed there, the recipients, tend to be these national organizations that are doing broad, you know, agendas around immigration and LGBT and women's rights, et cetera. And so the money would then go to those national organizations. But these platforms actually do have these abilities to give locally, too. And they also have live streams, so you can tell your story better in order to engage donors in a more creative way. Twitter has a new thing called Trigger, where you can donate that way. So lots of opportunities.
Well, let's hope some of those organizations are listening and are making plans, because they're going to need them. That's the one thing we know for sure amidst all this change. I want to thank you so much for coming in and giving us an update.
Happy to be here, Bethan. Thank you so much.
Lisa Maruyama is the president and CEO of the Hawaii Alliance of Nonprofit Organizations. HANO, as it's known, works to strengthen and unite the nonprofit sector in Hawaii and support best practices, and that includes measuring the impact of foundation dollars. HANO will hold a town hall on May 11th and will be talking with the head of the National Council of Nonprofits, Tim Delaney.
Earlier in the show, we talked about the Merry Monarch Festival and how at its inception, hula was not on the program. The year was 1963, and Hilo officials were looking to attract tourists to the Big Island. In 1964, activities included a King Kalakaua beard look-alike contest, a recreation of the king's coronation, and a barbershop quartet contest. In 1971, under the advice of hula masters Auntie Dottie Thompson and Uncle George Naope, a hula competition was introduced with 9 women's halau entered. For today's quiz, we asked you who won the inaugural Miss Aloha Hula title, and the answer is Aloha Dalier, won under her maiden name Aloha Wong. She remained deeply involved with the Merry Monarch Festival for more than 4 decades, and 3 of her daughters have also won the Miss Aloha Hula title in 1991, 1992, and 1999. That's our quiz. Nobody got that today, but if you've got one for us, send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Opera lives in the territory between reality and myth and thrives on intensely dramatic situations and extravagant emotions. Plenty of both can be found in Haupu, a Hawaiian opera, which tells the story of the abduction of a princess sometime in the last millennium. Herb Mahilona is the composer, and we spoke with him yesterday.
It's perfect for opera, almost perfect for Wagner, actually.
Yeah.
All the emotions, the romance, the conflict, the family struggles, it's the stuff that operas, great operas, made of.
And there's some of the descriptions of it make an analogy to Helen of Troy, and it seems like a pretty apt analogy in that she's abducted, right?
Right. So actually, our version is based on Kalakaua's version in his Myths and Legends of Old Hawaii, and he actually calls it the Tale of Hina, the Helen of Hawaii.
Uh-huh. Well, let's sort of capsulize that story, if you would.
So this is takes place right about when the last wave of migration happened, when the last group of Hawaiians came in with Pa'au and the Hawaiian system of life that we're familiar with. So prior to that, there was an older culture. And, of course, there was warfare between the islands, and the new system was being resisted by the chief on Molokai, named Kapepe Kawila, the last stronghold. And because he lived on a fortress high on those cliffs on the north side of Molokai, pretty much impenetrable.
A natural defense, isn't it?
Natural defense. So his only strategy was hopefully he could barter some kind of peace by kidnapping the wife of the chief of Hilo and kind of holding her for ransom, and hopefully that'll bring an end to the conflict. But unfortunately, she has two warrior sons that are very powerful and very skilled, and there's already a prophecy that their civilization will fall anyway. And then to make it more operatic, after the chief's wife is abducted and taken to Molokai, the two of them fall in love.
As if it weren't operatic enough, right?
Right.
Well, and what are the old ways that this Molokai chief was seeking to preserve?
So it was an older, from what we know, of course there's not much left of it, it was an older communal system where the ali'i and the chiefs kind of walked among the commoners. It was more democratic.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So there was no separation between the chiefs and the commoners. Whereas under the new system, of course, if the shadow of the chief touched you, you would die.
Yeah.
It became very strict.
So the kapu system was, in fact, more rigid than what preceded it. That's interesting.
Yes.
What do you think brought, did some social change bring that about, do you think? What do you think that was?
It could have been social change. There could have been a social need for more structure. So usually societies tend to go to a more structured society when there's chaos. I think there might have been a lot of infighting among islands, and a stricter system was kind of a way to bring order to the chaos. That's my theory.
Sure. And there's no way really to know, is there?
No.
But that's where opera lives, giving you opportunity to kind of speculate a little bit and fill in blanks in the story.
Right.
And then your task in particular was to make this a musical storytelling event. And how did you go about that?
Oh, well, that's the fun part. That's really the fun part, especially when you're talking about cultures and times that don't exist anymore. So you try to make it sound Hawaiian, but older. So I went to a lot of sources that are older than the Hawaiian culture we have. So there's some ancient Egyptian influences in there. There's some old Native American influences that predate, the last Hawaiian migration. And kind of incorporate that into the Hawaiian. So try to get a kind of primitive feel.
Sure. And I would assume kind of using the sounds of mele, getting as back as and far in Hawaiian musical history as it's possible to get, yeah?
Yes. Yeah.
But
and
that's
kind of interpolating what it might have sounded like prior to the current Hawaiian culture.
Which involves what sort of particular choices of scales that evoke an earlier time, rhythms that evoke an earlier time, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so there's a repetitive rhythm that kind of happens throughout the opera. That's kind of the rhythm of the encroachment of the new system. And then there's a lot of dissonance, more percussive sounding. So the opera starts out very percussive and dissonant. As the son of Hina is born, this supernatural being, this thunder and lightning and all kinds of dissonant chords as he comes to life. And so that kind of thing, trying to musically take the audience back.
The dissonance you referred to is often used in opera, Herb, as you know, to denote conflict, chaos, things of that nature, yeah?
Yeah. So in this case, I've also used it to symbolize a lack of a imposing system that forces people to be in a specific role. So instead of a forced harmony, there can be a polyphony of many different sounds that exist, and it's accepted. So we call it dissonance, but in another sense, it's a freedom.
Sure. Yeah, well, that's two sides of the same coin, right?
Right.
Well, you also have, in evoking ancient Hawaii, you have a challenge to instrumentation, don't you?
Right, because our chosen instrumentation for all our school presentations is the high school band.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got tubas and flutes and saxophones, you know, portraying an ancient Hawaiian,
yeah.
ancient Hawaiian legend. So it's quite a challenge, but what it does is creates a sonic background that is very unique sounding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not, it adds depth, I think, to just the drums and the pahu and the ipu.
Mm-hmm.
You get these deep chords, and the instruments can actually convey a lot of the emotion.
Sure, sure.
Which is what, you know, propels the opera forward.
Well, you know, an orchestra is, you know, used as an instrument in itself, offers for you as a composer a really wide range of possibilities, doesn't it?
Right. So I kind of went with a Wagnerian model.
Mm-hmm.
So every character kind of has their little theme
mm-hmm.
that comes on, and whenever the character is referred to, the theme comes out mm-hmm. you know, underneath. Because the original version was 3 hours long that we did at the school.
Yeah.
So they kind of needed the music. I understand why Wagner did it, because the operas are so long, you need the music to make sense
sure.
to the audience. So the version of Mari will only be 90 minutes, though. It
well,
won't be 3 hours.
That's plenty, you know, isn't it?
Yeah.
And at the same time, you know, an operatic composition has to have such strong elements of storytelling as well as musicality, doesn't it?
Right, right. And it has to flow. The whole, you know, presentation has to just move from, you know, one musical idea to the next. And I think that's the challenge, is to mm-hmm. stitch it all together, you know, into a big whole.
And then, of course, a large percentage of the audience is not going to understand the language, which happens a lot in opera. So
right.
How do you go about conveying that those aspects of story to people who aren't going to understand the Hawaiian language?
Yeah, so we work really hard. Well, on my side, I work really hard to have the music itself convey what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you'll know when somebody's in love and when they're about to fight. And then we worked really hard with the students to get them to communicate. And this was really important when we took it to Scotland, you know, to an audience that is not familiar with Hawaiian culture at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so everything is foreign.
Sure.
So they've learned to gesture and, you know, emote and, you know, to make the action understandable.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully it's still there. I think we still got it.
Herb Mahilona is the composer of Haupu, a Hawaiian opera. The Kamehameha School's Hawaii production will be performed in Maui's Castle Theater tomorrow evening.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Achieve 3000, working with Hawaii's educators to provide new support for ELL instruction with the Hawaii edition of Kid Biz Access, Teen Biz Access, and Empower Access. Achieve3000.com.
It's time to look ahead to the weekend, and as always, there are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state. Morning Edition host and colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. And Derek, you got one for those who like to rummage.
Yes, there is a rummage sale happening tomorrow near downtown Honolulu. It's at Harris United Methodist Church, and that's across from Foster Botanical Garden. You can purchase gently used clothing, kitchenware, toys, books, white elephant, and linens at bargain prices. Ono baked goods will also be for sale. All are welcome. That's happening tomorrow, 8:30 a.m. till 12:30 p.m. at Harris United Methodist Church, right across from Foster Botanical Garden on Nu'uanu Avenue.
And with May Day coming up, it's time for young people to learn how to make lei, yeah?
Yes. Teens have to head down to Kapolei Public Library tomorrow to do this, but you have to put down your phones for about an hour.
That's going to be a struggle.
I know. All supplies will be provided. I learned how to make a ribbon lei for May Day or a friend's graduation. This workshop is from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. You can call the library to reserve your spot at 808-693-7050. You can find that number on our website. Or you can stop by the Kapolei Public Library to sign up. This is happening tomorrow, and the program is for teens ages 13 to 18.
And there's an opportunity to hear chamber music in Waimea.
Yes, Kona residents Roland Maurer and his wife Ursula Hess. This is happening on Sunday. They make up Orlando's Chamber Ensemble. They'll present a colorful bouquet of salon music from the 19th and the early 20th century. It's on Sunday from 4 to 5:30 p.m. in the Holoholoku Clubhouse in Waimea on the Big Island. It's free, but donations are welcome.
And on Sunday, the streets are going to be blocked off in Kailua.
Oh, yes. Taste of Kailua takes place on Kailua Road from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. And they'll have the usual. It's food and Keiki Fun Zone, plants and orchid displays, and more.
Sounds like fun, Derek. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that are going on under the radar.
We want to extend a huge thank you to everyone who supported HPR in any way for all the kind comments and the good wishes, the great food, and of course the financial commitments to keep this station strong. Heartfelt thanks truly from all of us. Now, as we join the conversation live with the pledge drive ending as it did, there are parts of the show that you missed, but guess what? They will be on the 7 p.m. rebroadcast, so make sure you tune in at 7 p.m.
And that's our executive producer, Beth Ann Kosloby.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Amber Kahn are our production assistants.
The Backyard Quiz theme is written for us by John DeMello, and I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We will meet you back here on Monday when we pick up the conversation. Enjoy your weekend.